I wish when I was a kid I had more facility in being able to quote the Bible, because I could have said to my mom, "Did you wash your hands before you came to the dinner table? It is not, a person is not defiled by washing their hands before they eat, or not washing their hands." I could have said that, see, glibly. Ed Friedman, the great systems guy who I read a lot about and have a great respect for, said that his own son, when he was a little boy, you know, 3 or 4 years old, would say to him, "Do you think I might be able to have a soda? Or do you think it might be okay if I have a little ice cream?" So finally, after a lot of this, he said, "From now on, you have to ask for something directly. And if you don't do that, then you can't have it." So the next time at dinner, they were having peas, which he particularly disliked. And so as they were passing the food around, he said to his dad, "Do you think I might have some peas?" Over the last several weeks, the focus of the preaching, or my preaching, has been on the reading from Genesis, where we have been introduced to the great patriarchs and matriarchs of the Hebrew Bible, and of the Gospel, where we have had various teachings of the Savior and descriptions of parables, which are part of the way in which we learn to understand the nature, cost, and ways and means of Christian discipleship. Over the last 3 or 4 weeks, the readings from Genesis have afforded the opportunity to talk about how we might understand families, and maybe to see that even though the families that are described in the book of Genesis are constituted far differently than our own families, there are some lessons to learn from what we read and hear about in the Sunday readings. So I want to preach on today's reading about Joseph, or the end of the Joseph cycle, if that's the right way to say it, and then to preach on the Gospel, where we have two sections. One where Jesus is talking to his disciples about the importance of our interior emotional and spiritual states as being important with regard to achieving some species of purity of heart. And the second part, which is Jesus' initial rejection of listening to a Gentile, the Canaanite woman, who comes to him and asks that he help her daughter, who is afflicted by a demon, and see if we can make any sense out of a portrayal in this particular part of the Gospel, a portrayal of Jesus that is not particularly attractive. Last week we read about Joseph in the beginning of the story of Joseph, which is Joseph being sold into slavery. And we did not read in course all of the intervening events in Joseph's life leading up to today, which is sort of the culmination or the climax of what everything in Egypt was leading up to, and in fact his being sold into slavery. So let me fill you in briefly. Joseph is sold into slavery by his half-brothers. Remember I mentioned last week that Jacob had 12 sons. The biblical witness doesn't say anything about any daughters, but I expect there were probably some daughters sprinkled into this mix as well. Joseph had two wives, Leah and Rachel. They were sisters. There's an unusual thing. We don't hear of that today, do we? And Leah had two servants, Zilpah and the other one whose name escapes me now. Bila. Who?
Bila.
Bila, right. And they had four sons by Bila and two by Zilpah. And then Rachel, Jacob's great love, had two sons, Joseph, and the youngest, Benjamin. So we've got a mixed, we got the blended family of the ancient Near East. Joseph is not well liked by his brothers, his half-brothers, and there may be some actual reasons for their dislike, not only because of their position in the family system, but also Joseph may have understood his favored status and behaved in a way that was less than attractive. Be that as it may, Joseph gets sold into slavery. When he's in Egypt, he becomes part of the household of a man named Potiphar. And he is very resourceful. He's a survivor. He's successful at what he does, and he becomes now rising up through the ranks of the servants or the slaves, and he's virtually running Potiphar's household. But as things develop, Mrs. Potiphar hits on him, to put it diplomatically, and he refuses her blandishments. When I was a young priest in Tucson, Arizona, the rector of the parish I began my ministry in went to seminary in the late 1940s and early 1950s, and it was during the great spate of the musicals, Broadway musicals. And so some of his classmates wrote a musical about Joseph. And one of the songs in the musical that they wrote was entitled "Too Far, Mrs. Potiphar." Joseph gets thrown in jail because Mrs. Potiphar lies about her behavior. But while he's in prison, he learns some things about a talent he has, and that is the ability to interpret dreams. And he interprets the dreams of some servants of the Pharaoh. And as the result of that, they report his facility to the Pharaoh. And as it turns out, he interprets a dream for the Pharaoh, which predicts a coming famine in Egypt. And so he turns out to be right. And because of him being right, they're prepared. Joseph now rises in his power in Egypt. And it sounds like he, in the story, is virtually second only to the Pharaoh in power and authority. It is here that his brothers return from where they came from, because they have now felt the effects of the famine, which was not prepared for where they lived, and they needed food. Joseph recognizes his brothers, and he is overcome by the experience. It doesn't tell you this in the story, but they come initially. He doesn't help them until they go back and get his brother Benjamin and bring him so he can see his full brother. They come there, and when he admits to them that he's Joseph, they are very dismayed, because they know what they did, and this is a powerful person now who was in a position to cause them great distress and difficulty. This is a story from the ancient Near East about family conflicts and abuse. And it's about a suggested way, in this particular case, of how it can be handled. How conflict in family, hostility, broken relationships, and how they can be in some way repaired. Because Joseph cuts through everything, and he forgives them by demonstrating justice and compassion. It is very easy, and would have been very easy, for Joseph to have remained in the victim mode and to have either sought revenge or to have completely dissolved in the face of the presence of these brothers. Now, here's some other things we learn from the story. Because if we're going to apply it to the way families deal with conflict, sometimes very serious conflict, we know that it often is either not safe or appropriate for people who have suffered in their families to be able to be too close to them. And you will notice that when Joseph reconciles with everybody, he makes provision for them to live not in Egypt, but in Goshen. Near, but not too near. And that's a reminder that sometimes we can seek reconciliation and connection in our family, but we don't need to be and shouldn't be too close, because it's simply not emotionally or spiritually good to do that. But what Joseph also shows is a demonstration of some emotional and spiritual maturity. I think it comes from the leadership that he learned being in a position of authority in Egypt. You know, sometimes we learn how to do stuff from oblique places. The patron saint of parish priests, the Curé d'Ars, a Frenchman who lived during the Napoleonic Wars, was a terrible student. He almost flunked out of seminary. He was a draft dodger. And when he got allowed to go to seminary during the time of Napoleon, they said, "This guy is never going to make it." He finally did make it, and they ordained him and put him in a little backwater called Ars, A-R-S, where his reputation grew over the years, and he became a world-renowned spiritual director and confessor. And people from everywhere came to make their confession to him and to speak to him about spiritual matters. It was said of him that he had developed the power of discernment. I'm using this to relate to Joseph's capacities. And when the Curé d'Ars was asked, late in his life, how did he get the power of discernment? He said, "I got the power of discernment through having to learn how to apply myself so that I could learn Latin." It wasn't discernment. It was some kind of process whereby he learned something about how to focus and how to see and how to put two and two together. There's stories of him stepping out of the confessional and going back in the line of people who were waiting to get in and saying to some woman from another village nearby, "You know, you really ought to let your daughter marry that man. He will make her a very good husband." And she practically fainted dead away, right? So think about how powers of discernment can sometimes help you, and you can learn it through other sources. I think Joseph learned this non-anxious ability, the power to forgive, the ability to show justice and compassion when he didn't need to, by virtue of those skills and abilities. And so you might search your own inventory of skills and abilities and see if it will have any assistance to you if you need to do some repair work in your family or in your relationships. You may discover you have strengths you didn't know about. So, we learned something about the practice of justice and compassion in relationship in the reading from Genesis. In Matthew's Gospel, the first part is about Matthew, actually more than Jesus, but in the sense of the way he includes this information in his Gospel. Talking about our internal states, what's in the heart, our motives as being important. This is addressing a concrete problem that was at issue when Jesus exercised his earthly ministry because of the criticism he received about who he associated with, and that Matthew was dealing with in his Christian synagogue, from a party in Judaism that had now risen to prominence in about 85 to 90 AD called the Pharisees. And they said, "You need to continue to keep meticulously the Jewish law. And that means all of the rituals and the purity laws that have been part of our tradition, you must keep. And Jesus is saying to his apostles and disciples that it is not what goes in us from food or from any of the ritual practices that we practice that defiles us, but it is our interior states, our thoughts, our ways of being and relating that create the situation that produces defilement. And so he is speaking, making a commercial message for purity of heart. Purity of heart is not a super pious condition whereby you and I find the capacity to think religious and pure thoughts 24/7. Purity of heart, defined by some of the spiritual masters of Christianity, is to will one thing. To say that you wish to live a life congruent with God's will and purpose for you, and to seek in the ordinary and commonplace activities of your own life the ways and the means to do that, and to begin to make the conclusions that are often oblique between things that you do and their deep spiritual significance. And that you understand that as you do that, there needs to be greater proximity between the letter and the spirit. So going through the motions isn't going to do it, or just thinking good thoughts is not going to do it. But it is the moving together of the external, putting it in your hands, motivated by your pure intentions, your ability to stay focused and to will one thing. So in this first part of the gospel, Jesus says to his community, it isn't the washing of the hands that makes you pure, it's understanding internally how now to approach life, what it is that you should do. Matthew takes these words and applies them to a constituency within his Christian synagogue that are adamant about the keeping of the Jewish law and behaving in an exclusive fashion with regard to the Gentile community in that church who have now become 80%. So Matthew is part of the 20%, and it has occurred to him now that we must see that God's plan of salvation includes not just we, the people of the covenant, the special covenant, but it includes everyone, and it is part of God's plan now and in the future. So we read this and move now to an example where it appears that the Savior isn't buying it. A Canaanite woman, a Gentile, comes to him and he won't even see her. His disciples say, you got to see this woman. She's been very insistent. And he said, I have come to save the lost sheep of Israel, not the Gentiles. That is not my mission. They say, you really need to see her. She's just insisting. It isn't because they...